Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this month's, the inaugural session this academic year of the Spotlight on Pain Management. I'm Bob Kearns. I'm one of the directors of the Pain Management Collaboratory. I'm delighted to have all of you here today for this inaugural presentation of a series of presentations throughout this academic year, actually scheduled through June of 2025, highlighting work or accomplishments of our investigators and investigator teams from the Pain Management Collaboratory. But I want to say just another word about this series itself before elaborating a little more on the series. The Spotlight on Pain Management series has been in existence in one way or another for over 20 years, two decades plus, bringing the latest science and practice initiatives about pain management, particularly highlighting VA initiatives to the broader community. And I'm delighted to be here as one of the partners for this enterprise, along with the Pain Management Opioid Safety PDMP Program Office and VA Central Office, and Dr. Friedhelm Sandrick, as the Executive Director, is here with us today. It's also co-sponsored by the Prime Center based at VA Connecticut, and the Pain Opioid Consortium for research funded by Health Services Research, as well as the Pain Management Collaboratory. The Pain Management Collaboratory itself is an important tri-government agency partnership involving the NIH, particularly the National Center for Complementary and Integrated Health, but also other interested and investing centers and institutes and program offices, along with the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs research programs. Our principal aim is to support the successful conduct of now 16 separately funded pragmatic clinical trials of non-pharmacologic approaches for the management of pain and common co-occurring conditions. The collaboratory began in 2017, and we're starting to see the fruits today with today's presentation of the outcomes of our first successfully completed projects. Additional aims of the collaboratory are to really identify and disseminate information about lessons learned in the context of our collaboratory, as well as much broader dissemination activities, which includes this webinar series. So as I said, this is the first of a series that will extend through the end of the academic year next spring. So all of you who joined today, thank you for your interest. If you have interest in this presentation, please consider registering for the other presentations. You should all have information about how to do that, at least through the December sessions, and then you'll see a follow-up later on. It's my real terrific pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today. I've known Diana for longer than probably either of us would like to admit. Diana is a social psychologist, a core investigator, and director of the VA Advanced Fellowship Program in Health Services Research at the Center for Care Delivery and Outcomes Research, CCDOR, at the Minneapolis Veterans Affairs Healthcare System. She's also director of the VA Queer Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, Complementary Integrative Health Evaluation Center. And she's professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. As a social psychologist with additional training in organizational behavior and health services research, Dr. Burgess has over 20 years of experience conducting research in health equity and chronic pain. And her current research focuses on innovative approaches to delivering complementary and integrative approaches for chronic pain conditions, with an emphasis on improving access, quality, and equity. Today, she'll be presenting on the results of her pragmatic clinical trial that was part of the collaboratory. Her title is Scalable Mindfulness-Based Interventions for Chronic Pain, Results from the Learning to Apply Mindfulness to Pain, or LAMP, trial. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you so much, Bob. And thank you, everyone, for being here today. It's so great to kick off this seminar series. So I first want to acknowledge everyone who helped us over since we initiated this project in 2017. So all of the study team And especially all the veterans, many of whom have lived experience with pain. So all the veteran collaborators are in blue. That includes our veteran engagement panel and members of our stakeholder advisory panel, and also Adam Anisich and the Pain Management Collaboratory Patient Resource Group. I also want to thank, of course, our operational partners, so Dr. Friedhelm Sandbrink and Ben Kliegler, and the Department of Defense that funded the study through the Pain Management Collaboratory. That was amazing. And also NCCIH that also supported our work. And of course, VA, where I've had the privilege to be an investigator for over 2 decades. So I'm going to be talking about this, the results of our LAM study that was recently published in JAMA Internal Medicine under the title Telehealth Mindfulness-Based Interventions for Chronic Pain, the LAMP Randomized Clinical Trial. And most of the citations that you might want to look up are in this paper. There's a QR code, and there's also a great commentary that we had the honor and surprise to receive from Dr. Jan Shurkin, Overcoming Challenges to Implementing Mindfulness Pain-Based Pain Interventions, that really calls out a lot of the great work in VA and how VA, as in integrated, the nation's largest integrated healthcare system, really has been a leader in being able to deliver non-drug interventions for pain at a broad scale, and kind of talking about how can the rest of the nation follow. So I would encourage you to read that. But focusing on this study, really, as a background, we know that veterans need and want better ways to manage their pain. And this really is true for the many Americans in the United States with chronic pain. But veterans in particular, US military veterans, are disproportionately affected by chronic pain, as well as co-occurring conditions that occur with chronic pain, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, depression, also fatigue and sleep disorders. And they're also more affected by opioid harm, such as opioid use disorder and opioid overdose. So evidence-based non-drug treatments for chronic pain are recommended by major organizations, including the VA, yet they continue to be underutilized due to patient, provider, and system-level barriers. And this is true even in the VA, although again, the VA is a leader in offering non-drug approaches, including complementary and integrative health approaches to pain through whole health. But nonetheless, there's barriers. There's barriers in knowledge at the patient and provider level, and there's capacity barriers where it's very hard to offer all the people, which in the VA, we have 9 million patients about, and at least half by some measures of chronic pain. And here's a couple of quotes from some focus groups we did from Black veterans with chronic pain a while back. I think about the time that we got into the military. It was great. Everything was fine. Our health was good. And we would like to continue with the same thing once we had gotten out or finished, but we can't because it seems like it gave us more pain. It hurt us more. We're out there helping the people, but it hurt us more, our bodies. Then when we ask for the help, we can't get the help. We gave them the help. And it's getting progressively worse. And they give us drugs. Yeah, there you go. Percocet, Tramadol, Vicodin. I said I don't want any more drugs. So I'm dealing with the pain without the drugs. So the long-term goal of LAMP was to make it easier for more veterans in VA to receive effective non-drug treatments for chronic pain. So LAMP has two mindfulness-based interventions, or MBIs, that are designed to be scalable, meaning you could deliver them on a wide scale. Again, the VA treats about 9 million veterans. They need to be accessible, and they need to be veteran-centered, that I'll talk about, really meet the needs of our veteran patients. And mindfulness-based interventions, or MBIs, are effective non-drug treatments for chronic pain and the co-occurring conditions that I talked about that affect many veterans. So again, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep disorders, So mindfulness really, it's defined in different ways, but it's basically paying attention non-judgmentally in the present moment with openness and curiosity. And MBIs teach mindfulness skills and concepts through practices like meditation and mindful movement. They're designed to foster this mindfulness, so non-judgmental awareness and acceptance, and they often occur in a group setting. And again, they're evidence-based treatments for chronic pain and also co-occurring conditions. So again, the thing about LAMB is we wanted to come up with a way to make MBIs more scalable and veteran-centric. So many MBIs, including the most widely tested MBI that you might have heard about, mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, are difficult to implement at a broad scale in healthcare systems, and they pose access barriers for patients. So they require trained mindfulness instructors. And if you look up the requirements for MBSR, it requires a lot of training. And also, these were typically done in person, so you need dedicated space. And I should point out, since we started the project, the VA's actually switched from providing MBSR to something called VA Calm, which is addresses some of these barriers. So it's delivered by full-time licensed VA clinicians who are highly trained and they're engaged in direct care. But it's still is more intensive and it does require clinicians to deliver it. So again, there are limits to how many people we can reach in VA. MBSR always, typically was done in person and there's a very high time commitment. So it was 8 2.5 hour group sessions and there was a day-long retreat generally and 45 minutes daily home practice. And some veterans, especially women, find the group format uncomfortable. A fairly high number of women have experienced military sexual trauma and other sexual trauma. So being in a group with men or a mixed sex group was a reported barrier. And again, the in-person format posed barriers. So transportation, distance from the main facilities, and women have also experienced sexual harassment in VA. And if you think about if you've ever driven to a VA and you've parked and something is 2.5 hours, this could really take up a large part of your day. So we wanted the LAMP MBI to be scalable, accessible, and veteran-centered. And we also really wanted to address the needs of women veterans, because women veterans, as I'll talk more about, are disproportionately impacted by chronic pain and co-occurring conditions like mental health disorders and contributors to chronic pain. So the LAMP study oversamples women who are underrepresented in studies of veterans because really they're not a big proportion of people in the VA, but yet they're a very important group and they're growing and they're more likely to be minoritized and to again have a lot of the risk factors for chronic pain. There's also more references in our methods paper. So I was trying very deliberately, and I know for this series, not to talk about jargon, not to use jargon, but I really wanted to introduce the term biopsychosocial when we're talking about pain, because I do think even though it's a little jargony, it's really important. Because chronic pain is this complex biopsychosocial phenomenon that involves the whole person. And so basically, if you look at the picture on the right, what it means is that, there's a physiological or, a biological component to pain. We think of this as sort of a biomedical thing, something that can be seen on the scan. But chronic pain doesn't always, is also, there's a psychological component and there's a social component. And I'll talk more about that. And all of these components are important, in actually many conditions, but particularly in chronic pain. And veterans and VA patients are disproportionately impacted by these biopsychosocial factors that contribute to chronic pain and are exacerbated by pain. So this includes psychological factors like depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And what we think about social factors is sort of exposure to trauma, to discrimination that affects pain, sexual trauma, childhood trauma, social support affects pain. And, income and education levels, especially, income. In our study, as you'll see, people were more disadvantaged. So LAMP is grounded in this biopsychosocial model aimed at improving physical, psychological, and social outcomes. And there's a nice quote that Dan Shurkin provided in his commentary about MBIs. MBIs do not directly target the patient's condition. Rather, they target the counterproductive ways in which patients think about and react to their problems. They provide patients with strategies and tools to help them create the time and space to become more fully aware of what is going on in their minds and hearts that's ne negatively impacting their lives. So it really is much more of a whole person approach, as you'll see. Okay, so here's an overview. So the objective of LAMP is to test the effectiveness of two MBIs designed to be scalable and accessible at improving veterans' chronic pain and biopsychosocial outcomes. The interventions contain the core elements of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which have been widely tested, but they're also grounded in behavioral change strategies using the behavioral change wheel model. So I'll talk more about this, but this is something that, we're trying to change people's self-management behaviors, and we're grounding this in behavioral change theory and research. The group MBI was comprised of 8 90-minute structured group sessions and an introductory session zero. And it was delivered via video conferencing. And this was not what we had planned, but between our pilot study and phase one of this project and the larger trial phase came the pandemic. And we made the decision, since we didn't know how long this would be, to deliver it via telehealth. And at the time, the VA actually reduced a lot of the regulatory barriers that made it easier to deliver this via video conferencing. So that was very exciting because at the time, it wasn't as common to deliver these types of things via telehealth. So we used pre-recorded mindfulness education and skill training videos that were done by an experienced mindfulness instructor with facilitated discussions by VA staff that did not have to be a trained mindfulness instructor. So again, this makes it scalable. So you don't need to have these trained mindfulness instructors and also help fidelity because it would be delivered the same way. Then there was the self-paced MBI, which was comprised of 8 30 to 60-minute weekly modules, which were the same pre-recorded videos that people would complete on their own, either on a mobile app or on the video or on, their computer or tablet. And it was supplemented by 3 individual facilitator calls by VA staff. In both groups, in both conditions, all participants were encouraged to practice on their own between sessions using a workbook, the mobile app, and the study website. And the development was led by co-I Dr. Ronnie Evans, and it was based on our R33 funded by NCCIH, where they really developed this idea of having the mindfulness instructor deliver this content virtually. Okay, so just a quick snapshot. How is the LAMP MBI different from other MBIs? So it's the same general principles and concepts, especially, we really grounded it in MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and the content was presented by experts. But we did some things to enhance accessibility, engagement, adherence, because again, adherence is pretty low in across mindfulness-based stress reduction programs. Fidelity, can it be repeated? Sustainability and scalability, can it be widespread? So shorter length, it integrates specific behavior change techniques. We try to use less jargon. Again, we recorded the sessions by an expert instructor, facilitated by non-experts. And this really, I think, helps fidelity. And it is very what we call manualized. We have very specific materials, so it's always delivered pretty much the same way by the facilitators, more structured sessions. We made it very specific to pain. So MBSR is used for a lot of things, but we really made all the examples and explanations very central to pain. We customized it for veterans, including the needs of women veterans. It was trauma-informed. We had a self-paced version without the group component, and it was delivered via telehealth. We also developed our package, which was the mobile app, videos, workbook, facilitator training manual, and some slides through feedback from veterans, stakeholders, and experts. So we had our veteran engagement panel. This is some of them. And these were all veterans and VA patients with lived experiences with chronic pain. We had our stakeholder advisory panel, experts who had all sorts of expertise, including mindfulness, technology, veteran end users. We also incorporated a lot of pilot study data and data from other VA researchers who had done some qualitative work with veterans using mindfulness-based stress reduction. And our goal was to better understand veterans' capabilities, opportunities, and motivational needs for engaging in MBIs to support their adaptive pain behaviors. And this is the COMBI model, capability, opportunity, and motivational needs, which I'll talk about. We did do a cyber seminar 3 years ago where we talked about the intervention development in depth. But basically, the COMBI model is an evidence-based model that represents a synthesis of approximately 20 behavioral models, so it's very comprehensive. It was developed by expert panels and it was researched heavily, particularly in non-pain related fields. So the premise of this model is that for a behavior to occur, a person needs the capabilities, so the knowledges and the skills, the motivation, so conscious and unconscious, to enact the behaviors, and the opportunities, or, you know, and resources to be able to enact the behaviors. So even when we talk about self-management for pain, which is very important, it doesn't occur in a vacuum. People need to have these different elements to change their behaviors. And when we're talking about behavior, we conceptualized it as helpful pain self-management behaviors. So some of these are mindfulness skills, emotional and attentional regulation skills, shifts in self-talk, things that are all empirically known to improve people's pain. Okay, so in our when we did our development work, we found that veterans had capability-related needs, so they wanted things to be really clear. We actually led them through a sample session from MBSR, and they just had a lot of, they noted a lot of jargon, but their big thing is they really wanted to know, how can mindfulness help me with my pain? And I think that's true for a lot of non-drug treatments. People are used to a biomedical model, and they want to know, well, how will this work? So we really came up with language about the mind-body connection. I just got, hold on. Sorry. Okay, I got some weird, my settings changed. But anyway, they also had opportunity and resource related needs. They wanted the app to be usable, flexible. They wanted cues, reminders, written materials. They, you know, liked the idea of shorter session lengths. They wanted to be able to make up missed sessions. So we made sure everything would be available if they missed a session. They really wanted it to be more secular, less jargon. They cared about support from other veterans. They wanted the sessions to be on track and a lot of reminders and guidance for home practice. And women in particular wanted guided meditations and a female voice. We did some usability interviews with the apps, and women talked about their military sexual trauma and how they didn't want to necessarily have a male voice. Okay, so this was a three-arm design. We had three groups, the group MBI, the self-paced MBI, and usual care. Everybody was in treatment as usual, but one group didn't get the intervention. This was called a hybrid type 1 effectiveness implementation, pragmatic clinical trial. Basically, while we did the trial to see which worked better, we also wanted to understand barriers to implementing this in VA at different levels, like from a patient perspective, from a systems perspective. We conducted this with patients from Minneapolis, Durham, and Greater LA, but again, it was done via telehealth. This is the eligibility criteria. Just briefly, number one was from the medical records. They needed to have these two qualifying pain diagnoses that were very broad. Then they did a survey online. That's two, three, four, and five. We wanted to make sure that they really had chronic pain. So we asked them some questions. They needed to have access to a smartphone and the internet. They couldn't be currently enrolled in another pain study or mindfulness-based stress reduction. And then six, we did a chart review, and you could look at this, but basically, we wanted to make sure that you didn't have a really active, kind of more serious mental illness or current symptoms that might make it hard for them to fully participate, particularly since the groups were not run by MBSR instructors or, clinicians. And I'm happy to take more questions. So our primary outcome is something that's pretty self patient-centered. It's pain-related function measured by the Brief Pain Inventory Interference Scale over 12 months. The range is 0 to 10, and a higher score means you have more interference or worse function. We also looked at some secondary biopsychosocial outcomes. So we had a few other pain measures, pain intensity, this measure called global impression of change, like do you find improvement in your pain? And we looked at the percentage improvement in their pain functioning from baseline. We looked at some psychological measures, anxiety systems, depressive symptoms, PTSD symptoms. For health, we looked at physical function, fatigue, sleep disturbance, and we also looked at participation in social roles and activities. Okay, so results. So here's a participant flow diagram. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but you could see that we used the medical record to send a lot of recruitment materials out, over 27,000. And we were able to do this because we emailed most of them through the medical records. And we've actually published on this, and we found that it was more efficient to send things out during an email. We have higher response rates. And this is true even for groups that you don't typically think of as responding to email, such as older people and people from minoritized groups. About 1,900 were eligible based on our screener, and 1,700 about completed the survey. And one of the reasons why people, didn't want to, couldn't do this was you had to be able to attend one of the group sessions. We wanted to make sure everybody would be able to do that, even though they were going to be randomized. Then we included 407 people because of chart review. We contacted everybody. You could see on the right. And again, some people who thought they could do it found out that they weren't going to be able to make some of the sessions. We randomized 811 to the three groups. If you look at the very bottom where it says follow-up, we got very high follow-up rates, especially given that this was over, we had a 12-month follow-up period. But as you can see, we had higher levels of follow-up in the usual care group. So this was not random missingness. So we did adjust for these in our analyses. Okay, so baseline participant characteristics. We managed to get almost half women. We were 68% white, 26% black. The mean age was 54.6 years. 94% had at least some college education, but only 31% described their household financial situation as living comfortably. This was the highest choice you could put for how comfortable are you? So, almost 70% were not did not say that they were in a comfortable financial situation. 41% were employed, 25% retired, 22% disabled. There were a lot of people, 63%, who had at least one mental illness diagnosis in the electronic health record. And that was even after excluding people because of a more serious mental health disorder. 40% had depressive disorders, that was the highest, also anxiety and PTSD. Okay, so I will talk about availability of the intervention. We did some baseline gender comparisons and we published this, but basically, women were more likely to have these chronic overlapping pain conditions, which I can talk more about, and higher pain interference and intensity. They had more psychiatric and sleep disorder diagnoses, more depression, anxiety, PTSD, fatigue, sleep disturbance, stress, and pain, catastrophizing, which is associated with, you know, greater chronic pain. And they had lower levels of pain self-efficacy. How well can they deal with their pain? Or do they report feeling like they can? And lower levels of participation in social roles and activities, more interference with their social roles. And so these are all, this all shows that women are more likely to be impacted by chronic pain in our sample. Women were also less likely to smoke, which was good, or have a substance use disorder, and use more non-pharmacological pain treatment modalities. Okay, so engagement. 69% of people in the group MBI completed at least 6 visits. This is considered adherent, but only 26% completed all 9 sessions. I mean, it was hard. They had to complete things on time. We had greater adherence in the beginning during lockdown, and when we had, and then once people were doing, you know, living their lives, adherence kind of fell off a little bit. But you know, at least 69% completed at least 6 visits. Adherence was slightly higher in the self-paced MBI. 76% completed at least 2 calls, which was considered adherent. 62% completed all 3 calls, and these calls were scheduled to meet their needs, so there was more flexibility. We also asked about people's practice engagement. So one of the things we wanted to do is we really cared about what we call these mini practices. So when you were stressed, could you do a type of breathing exercise or a type of exercise designed to kind of ground you or to show self-compassion? So in both groups at 10 weeks, 90% of people in both MBIs reported weekly practice. And at 12 months, over 80% said they did the mindful mini practices. It was a little lower for things like using their workbook, looking at the videos, but at least they were doing these kind of on-the-spot mindfulness. Okay, our primary analysis, again, we looked at pain-related function, lower is better. We looked at this over 12 months, so at 10 weeks, 6 months, and 12 months. I'm not going to talk about the whole analysis. You could read it, but an important point is that this was called an intention to treat analysis. So everybody is in the analysis, even the people who weren't adherent to the intervention. Even if people didn't show up to any of the groups or didn't do anything, they were still analyzed. And we also adjusted for what we call the design factors of our sampling frame. So, you know, when they got the survey site, we looked at there, we also adjusted for where they were at baseline. So their baseline pain interference. And we also adjusted for baseline pain self-efficacy. That was the only thing that differed at baseline. And we did some stuff to look at missing outcome data, because as you can remember, we had more missing data in the intervention conditions. Okay, so here is our big punchline. Pain functioning improved more in the 2 MBIs compared to usual care. That is, there was a greater reduction in pain interference scores over 12 months in both MBIs, so the self-paced and the group, and they didn't significantly differ from each other. So the gray or the top line is looking at the usual care, and at the very left you see baseline. And so this again is an adjusted model. So these are estimates. But everybody had the same, interestingly, all 3 groups after adjusting was at a 5.6 on the 0 to 10 BPI interference subscale. So, you know, higher level, more interference, it's worse. Then at 10 weeks, you see the biggest drop. In the gray, they did spontaneously get, you know, what go down to 5.3. In the blue, which is the group MBI, they went down to 4.8. And in the red, which is a self-paced MBI, they went down to 4.4. And so a drop of 1 point is considered clinically significant. So there was a drop, and then it persisted at 6 months and 12 months. Although, again, as you can see in the gray, people did, get better just without doing anything. But there was a significant difference between the two groups. So they both did better, but the MBIs did better than usual care. And here's another way of looking at it. Average across all three time points, the BPI pain interference score was lower for those in the MBIs versus usual care. And even though, so the middle line where it says averaged over three time points is the difference. So the first one is like you subtract the group MBI versus a self-paced, and you can see that there is a difference of 0.3. So there is still greater pain in the MBI group adjusted, but because we statistically adjusted for multiple comparisons, they didn't statistically differ, but you could see it looks like it's favoring the self-paced group. And then in the two other columns, both interventions were better than no intervention. And this is a graph that I think the clinicians that I've talked to were the most interested in. So what I showed you before looked at the three groups on average, but this analysis looks at people at the individual level and says, what are the percentage of people in each group that are experiencing either a moderate or substantial improvement in their functioning from baseline? So you start out, and everybody has a different level of baseline pain interference. It had to be at a certain, it had to be certain a certain level of pain interference to be in the study, but it did differ. And then, we measured them at 10 weeks, 6 months, and 12 months. And 30% improvement is considered moderate, and 50% improvement is considered substantial. So we looked at the percentages who experienced either moderate or substantial improvement across the three groups. So at 10 weeks, significant differences are in bold, and the two groups are in black. So at 10 weeks, 33%, so about a third of the people in the group MBI, and 40.3% of people in the self-paced MBI experienced moderate improvement, compared to 15.9% in usual care. And you see the same pattern of people experiencing substantial improvement. So that's at least 50% improvement. So 14%, 21% versus 6.6%. And at 6 months, this persisted for people experiencing moderate improvement. So now we're going to the 6 month, you go down, 34.4% experienced moderate improvement in the group, 38.2% self-paced MVI versus 22.2% in usual care. And then at 15, for people experiencing substantial improvement, that persisted at 6 months for the self-paced MVI. And at 12 months, we really just see these differences at between the self-paced MVI and usual between the self-paced MVI compared to usual care. So again, it was pretty impressive to us that even though the intervention ended at 10 weeks, we still saw 40.2% experiencing reporting a moderate improvement in pain-related function compared to 24.1% in usual care, and a similar pattern for people saying they experienced 50%. We also looked at these other pain and biopsychosocial outcomes. So this is looking at these outcomes over 12 months. And for all outcomes, in general, except for one for the group, people did better if they were in the MBIs. So this includes pain intensity, perceived change in pain. So, did my pain improve? Physical function, fatigue, sleep disturbance, depression, PTSD symptoms. For anxiety, interestingly, only the self-paced group showed an improvement over usual care and participation in social role activities. So what we were excited about was that even though these are not big differences, they're very consistent and they go across these biopsychosocial outcomes. We also have some qualitative data that we coded, and this starts shedding lights on how the LAMP intervention improve veterans' capability, motivation, and opportunity to, hopefully, influence their behaviors. So capability, again, are knowledge and skills. So here's a couple of representative quotes. It helps bring attention to the fact that some pain can be overcome and that we could still have a normal life with chronic pain. I definitely find myself using the mindful practices and movements more to clear my mind and replace negative thought spirals. So opportunity. It was great. This is for people who were in the groups. It was great to talk to other veterans, especially the females, to know I was not alone. The group interaction was so beneficial to me. Hearing what others do and the pain they experience and manage helped my perspective. And motivation. So motivation, we had these different subcategories. So one was goals, are you motivated to do stuff? And one was emotions. And things could be double coded. So, but here's goals. When the pain wakes me, I use the meditation and breathing to focus on relieving the pain. This is also skills. This does help and lessens the time I'm awake before the pain is reduced and I can again sleep. I am going to try doing the meditation before going to sleep and see if that helps. This also shows how, pain really is, multifaceted, right? People's sleep really tracks with their pain. And, this person used it to help their sleep. For emotions, this program helped me get out of the mindset and learn to be kind to my body when it was telling me to stop, as opposed to getting angry that I was in pain and unable to do things I used to do. And that was a big piece, this sort of, being kind to yourself, accepting, non-judging. So the bottom line is that two scalable telehealth MBIs improve pain, mental or psychological, physical, and social outcomes among veterans with chronic pain. So the effects were consistent across outcomes and were sustained over 12 months. The effectiveness of the MBIs generally didn't differ in comparisons of the group means, although the self-paced, as you can see, was superior in responder analyses. And there weren't gender differences in the primary outcome. And we've been looking more and really found, really did not find gender differences in terms of how well this worked. Let's see. Here is a nice kind of recap. This, they call it some kind of special abstract, or which is nice. So it just kind of shows you that, we had half men, half women, which is very exciting. We had three VAs. They're randomized to these groups. And as you can see on the very right, there really was an improvement at 10 weeks, 6 months, and 12 months for people in the two MBIs. Next step. So we're right now in the process of trying to explore why the group MBI wasn't superior to self-paced, and in some cases, why self-paced was better. That was surprising. It may be because people were able, adherence was higher in the self-paced MBI. We're also interested in what type of people or groups benefited most from the intervention. And that's something that I think people are very interested in the chronic pain world in general. So this idea of precision medicine, we're looking at groups such as women, such as people who have, mental health diagnoses, but we're also interested in whether we have different, pain diagnoses. So are certain pain diagnoses more like those people more likely to benefit? We're also looking at mediators of the intervention, or why did it work? So we're looking at stress. The intervention did reduce people's stress. It reduced pain catastrophizing, improved pain self-efficacy, and improved people's mindfulness. But we really want to see in a more fine-grained way, are there certain aspects, are there certain reasons why it worked better? Was it really that it changed people's self-talk, or was it that it reduced their stress? We also want to look at what we call the dose, the number of sessions attended, their home practice. We're also working with the Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation to implement the self-paced MBI first in the DA whole health system. And ideally, it would be delivered by whole health coaches, although we're still working with this because, there's a lot to implement something in a big healthcare system. And we also want to package this for broader dissemination. So right now, it is not widely available, but our goal is to make it more widely available. And finally, we've been funded by the National Institute of Nursing Research as part of the NIH HEAL, or Helping to End Addiction Long-Term Initiative, to test a complementary and integrative health intervention that non-drug intervention that addresses the needs of rural VA patients and overcomes existing barriers to pain care. And this is with NPIs Ronnie Evan and Katie Hadlin Smith. And really, so we're using something, this is kind of what we call LAMP adjacent. We're using a similar intervention where the content is delivered by experts, but it's facilitated in a group setting by VA coaches who don't have to be experts in mindfulness or complementary integrative health. And what's really important is that rural America is disproportionately affected by chronic pain, with higher rates of chronic pain. They're more likely to be prescribed opioids and less likely to use non-opioid interventions because of barriers. And rural patients of the VA with chronic pain are less likely to receive comprehensive and specialty pain care because they're further from the main VA sites that offer that. They're more likely to be prescribed opioids, are less likely to use self-management for pain, and have less access to complementary and integrative health treatment for pain. And RAMP is designed, it's going to be another pragmatic clinical trial to assess the effectiveness of an intervention called RAMP at improving pain and biopsychosocial outcomes among rural VA patients with chronic pain. So basically, it's another telehealth intervention, but we have more components. So we're also doing more exercises. We're addressing more things such as sleep, such as more with the psychological components. And we're collaborating with patients, community advisors, and VA healthcare system leaders to co-develop and evaluate how we can implement this, or basically get it to more veterans and adapt them to scale it up within the VA. So I want to thank everybody. Everybody's contributed to LAMP and RAMP and all of you for coming today. And now I'll take questions. And I think, Bob, you might have a couple of words.
So thank you, Diana, for an extraordinary piece of work, first of all, and for this wonderful presentation. I want to note a couple of things about this, in case people missed it. In this single trial, large-scale, multi-site pragmatic trial, Diana and her team successfully recruited over 800 veterans. I'd like to think, given the outcomes, that all of those veterans benefited from having the opportunity to participate in this clinical trial. Across all of our originally funded 11 trials, over 11,000 veteran service members and dependents have benefited through their participation in the PMC trials. It's an extraordinary effort, as most of you investigators and really anybody can see. So even that is incredible accomplishment. The fact that you emphasize the high level of integrity or fidelity of the trial and the details and its enactment and ultimately the demonstrated benefits in the two experimental interventions is extraordinary. Of course, these trials are all designed to address the gap between pre-existing evidence of the known efficacy, if not effectiveness, of these kinds of interventions. And their availability in routine clinical care. Of course, mindfulness interventions are growing in their availability and accessibility in the VA and elsewhere. So applause to many of you who are already engaged in that. I think I'll start with a question that was posed in the Q&A, which is really about where do things stand in terms of the availability of the tools, the resources that you used or studied in your intervention. Maybe Friedhelm or you can, or others can speak to that, but I'm just curious, and I think our audience is interested in what's the progress being made to make this more routinely available in VA, at least, if not elsewhere.
Yes, we do have a toolkit. So we have a manual for facilitators to train facilitators. We have how we hire like the people who deliver the intervention, because it is something that in both conditions that were successful, it wasn't just an off-the-shelf app. They either had coaching calls or they had a facilitator. So what we would like to do is to train people to deliver it in VA. And I think what we've all decided is that potentially this could be done by whole health coaches. I mean, you know, this is something that we've talked about with Friedhelm and Ben. And then we would like to make this package more widely available. But the tricky thing is, you know, it is sort of to be determined whether if you didn't have somebody giving the three coaching calls, would it work as effectively? But we do have an implementation toolkit with a very detailed, we have workbooks, we have all of the videos and materials, the training manual, slides that the facilitators use, scripts. So it should be able, and we have a supervision guide. So I do think we have a package, just making sure we could deliver it safely. The other thing is, we did have a safety protocol because this is a population that has high levels of comorbidity. So that is something that we want to be really careful with. So we did have to use our safety protocol. We didn't have any adverse events, but there were times that people did feel, you know, did get activated in the group setting. So we want to make sure that we deliver it safely to this population. So that is our goal, to get it out there, but to make sure it's safe and effective.
I see. Thank you. That's perfect. I see Dr. Sandbrink has come off mute. So Friedhelm, do you have any comments?
So thank you. First of all, I want to just express how exciting it is to have this, you know, cyber seminar series kicked off again for this coming academic year. And it really reminds me, Diana, that your presentation is the reason why we are doing this jointly, right? Because, you know, you have implemented something here, you know, you showed it in your research study, you know, how successful mindfulness can be, and you showed us how to do this possibly in the practice, right? So this is really, I think, an ideal way where we now have to move forward and say, okay, what can we do? And Bob, your question is very, you know, appropriate there, right? What can we do now to make this more widely available, right? One of the things that we've always said is, like, if we know what works, why don't we make it available, especially if it is, as you documented, can be done in a way that is relatively, you know, low resource intensive. It's a veteran self-paced approach, right? If you take that one arm where they do it themselves, and which is low risk. And if you really think about it, I mean, the way mindfulness it can be applied, it really is appropriate really for the vast majority of pain conditions. It isn't limited to the patients with specific joint pain or back pains, you know, as certain other modalities may be. This is something that we can broadly apply. And it really, I think, it helps to improve the veteran's ability to focus how their thinking work, right? I mean, it really retrains the brain to some degree in a way that is just universally applicable. So I'm certainly very excited about, you know, working with you, Diana, and the research community to try to find a way, okay, how can we now move this forward in a way to implement this? What we have to think about in our teams is obviously who are the right people to carry this forward. And I think the idea that you brought out, that whether that maybe are the whole health coaches who can do this, mindfulness considered one of those 9 items on the list one, right, of by the CRH modalities under the whole health approach. But we also want to set up our pain teams to truly successfully integrate this. So this isn't something that's on the fringes, you know, somehow is this like, oh, this is for the people who have maybe not, you know, responded well to the more traditional biological based approaches. No, this is something that should be at the forefront. This is something that should be offered, you know, for any patient who's interested in it, who engages in our pain specialty clinic or outside, obviously, who wants.
Yeah, anybody could be able to, you know, could have the script. I mean, the script is not that complicated with the coaching calls. I mean, the package really could be implemented by people in a variety of, you know, patient facing roles, right? So I think that's really exciting for him. So I, you know, that is our dream, that it's available and many people could use it and do the 3 check-ins, even if it's not a call. You could check in when you're meeting with your patients. We just still feel like it's probably good to have some kind of support.
Thank you, Diane and Freedom, for those comments. I'm aware of the time. I'll just, there are a few questions in the chat. Maria, I'll just go ahead because I can't see them. One is just a comment from a colleague who noticed the potential difference in the self advantage, I guess, slight in the self-paced group, and a point made that self-determination theory could be consistent with this approach. And I think more broadly in the field of pain management, I think we have a growing evidence base that supports providing tools to empower, and in our case, veterans, but people with chronic pain more broadly, around their development of their own individualized approach to pain self-management, where a tool such as this mindfulness-based intervention could be one of a toolkit, a portfolio of approaches. But the idea of really learning more about how to build that empowerment, self-efficacy in this population is, I think, important. There's also a question from a colleague. What factor or factors do you attribute, Diana, to leading the maintenance of effects, which seem to be strong in this study? Do you have some sense about sustaining benefits that you were able to demonstrate?
Yeah, I think some of it is what Freedom said, is that we were teaching things that were very specific to pain that people could apply in their daily life. And unlike MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which really focused on this 45 minutes of formal meditation, we specifically knew that we wanted to focus what we called mini mindfulness or on-the-go mindfulness. So if you can't sleep, what can you do? If you're stressed, what can you do? And in our qualitative data, we do have a lot of examples, such as the ones I presented, where people said, I use this, or I use this such and such exercise when I was feeling stressed, and just learning how to change their self-talk. So it's really, you know, that psychological piece as well.
Thank you, Diana. I'll just make a comment. There was another question about how do you get involved, and you know, if your site is interested in participating in one of these trials, how do you get involved? I think, first of all, I'd say that across the pain management collaboratory trials, almost, you know, a very large number of sites were engaged across virtually all states in the country, including Alaska and Hawaii. But that doesn't mean that there aren't sites that could be advantaged by participating. I think what you'll want to do is make sure that you are doing what you can to make help the pain community, the pain research community, aware of that interest. And I think there are a couple of different ways to do that. But potentially through the VA Pain Opioid Core is, you know, consortium for research could be a place to contact. I also want to note that I put in the chat an open funding announcement for additional pragmatic clinical trials of non-opioid implementation or integrated non-opioid interventions, integrated models of care, and highlighting more pragmatic implementation studies. So there is an notice of interest in funding or request for proposals out on the street, and I put that in the chat. I'd also highlight the pain management website as another part of our outreach efforts. I finally want to just say that I, of course, can't tell who's who on the list of participants. We have a large number of registrants and participants today. We're doing what we can to get the word out, including to veterans, service members, and the public. So I hope, actually, people with lived experience of pain and patients are actually engaged in coming to these sessions now. And please continue to spread the word. We really are doing what we can, or trying to do what we can, to make sure that the dissemination efforts are optimized. And with that, I'm going to, unless there's any other questions, I don't think there are. Let's see. Oh, there are a couple. I'll ask one more question. Did you note that the amount of rural veterans that registered for your program was signed up level proportional to the urban participants?
Yes, you know, because we're focusing on this, we're very interested. And I think we had about 35% rural veterans, but that was the VA definition. So they were not necessarily highly rural. And they seemed to sign up at about the same rate, and they did just as well. So we didn't see differences. And RAMP, we actually just got everybody very quickly signed up for our pilot study. So it seems like rural veterans are really interested in these mind-body approaches.
And there is one trial, relatively new trial in the Pain Management Collaboratory that is about a collaborative approach to outreach to rural veterans, being led by Travis Lovejoy and Ben Marasco from Portland. I want to thank Diana and everybody for your participation today. I'll turn things back over to Maria for any final comments.
Thank you so much for preparing and presenting for today, Diana. And for the attendees, thank you for everyone for joining us for today's HSR Cyber Seminar. When I close the meeting, you'll be prompted with the survey form. Please take a few moments to fill that out. We really do count and appreciate your feedback. Have a great day. We'll see you soon. Bye.